You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz, coming to you from Washington, D.C.
And this is your co-host, Ankit Panda, also in Washington, D.C.
How you doing, Ankit?
Doing pretty well. Gearing up for a busy autumn of quite a bit of traveling coming up, including to the Asia-Pacific region. So looking forward to that, but good to be back with you, Katie.
Fantastic. Yes, it's good to be back. So today we're going to discuss a recent development in the Indian Ocean, which I think took a lot of us by surprise, sort of this conclusion to clue our listeners in. 5 years ago, after the International Court of Justice issued a non-binding opinion stating that the UK had an obligation to bring to an end its administration of the Chagos Islands, London recently announced that it would indeed hand over sovereignty of the islands to Mauritius. Now, Mauritius was a British colony up until 1968, and it had long been packaged together with the Chagos Islands, which are, in physical sense, quite distant from almost everything in the Indian Ocean. As the British colonial empire was eroding, the British had actually separated the islands out into the British Indian Ocean Territory, which has the terrible acronym of BIOT. I don't know if anybody uses that, but it's terrible. In 1965, they did that. And so when Mauritius became independent, London kept control of the islands. Now, the Chagos Archipelago covers a group of 7 atolls, more than 60 islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The largest of its islands is known as Diego Garcia. And arguably, Diego Garcia is why we're talking about this latent bit of decolonization on this podcast. So, Ankit, let's start with these islands and their sort of outsized geopolitical role. Why is Diego Garcia significant, and why really did this take so long to resolve?
Yeah, sure, Katie. I think that was a really great scene setter. So, Diego Garcia is significant essentially for being the most significant operating node in the Indian Ocean proper, so actually in the Indian Ocean itself, for really the United States. It is a joint U.S.-UK facility pursuant to the U.K.'s previous claim of sovereignty over the British Indian Ocean territories and the Chagos Islands. So this is an important base. It features airstrips capable of allowing the United States to operate all of its current fleet of heavy strategic bombers, which the U.S. regularly does from Diego Garcia. So in terms of allowing the United States to project military power in the Indo-Pacific and in the Indian Ocean region specifically, Diego Garcia is in many ways kind of the analog to the U.S. territory in the Pacific of Guam in terms of the military relevance. And so the geopolitical relevance really does kind of center on this particular piece of soil. The other Chagos Islands have remained essentially uninhabited since the Brits evicted the Chagos people in the 1960s. So the kind of balancing act here for the UK was really about how to preserve access to this facility, which is an important joint facility for the US and the UK, while sort of navigating the increasingly untenable international legal position that the UK was forced into after the judgments that you talked about. So that's kind of the quick and dirty background here about the relevance of Diego Garcia.
Yeah. So what do we know about the deal that the British announced? And of course, it is subject to finalization of a treaty and legal documents. So it's not really a done deal, though the announcement is pretty significant. Can you go through some of the aspects of this deal and sort of how Diego Garcia sort of features in the overarching architecture?
Yeah, sure. So the basic gist, I mean, it's a pretty simple deal overall, right? The basic gist of it is that Mauritius gets sovereignty over all of the Chagos Islands, including Diego Garcia. But this transfer of sovereignty does not mean that the U.S. and U.K. lose access to Diego Garcia, because the Mauritians have agreed to lease it back to the U.K. under a 99-year lease, which is practically speaking, for the foreseeable future, going to allow the U.S. and U.K. to continue uninhibited use of this facility. So in a way, it optimizes for that balancing act I just described. It also, I think, resolves the international legal implications for the U.K. of essentially coming into compliance, right? And this has been kind of the subject of, we don't have to talk about this too much on this podcast, but the domestic debate in the U.K. has, I think, highlighted the level of discomfort that I think some have, right? So this was a decision made under a Labour government. Labour, notionally, I think, does give more creed to things like international law and international legal requirements. So the Starmer government, Keir Starmer is the current Labour Prime Minister, was criticized quite a bit by conservatives as having made this deal to compromise UK sovereignty, which quite literally speaking, this deal does, because it is a sovereignty transfer over a piece of territory administered by the United Kingdom. But it obviously is, in many ways, a lot more compliant with international law. And I think the reason this also bears importance is because in the Indo-Pacific, where you do have sovereignty disputes, maritime entitlement disputes from the South China Sea to land-based territorial disputes, the UK has been promoting the sanctity of international law against other countries, right? And so if the UK had sort of allowed this issue to continue festering, as it might have after 2019 in particular, after the ICJ ruling, that would have, I think, raised an obvious tension for the United Kingdom's ability to credibly pursue international law, right? And, you know, these kinds of double standards, I think, exist elsewhere. I think the most familiar one to many of our listeners on this podcast is probably the U.S. approach to the law of the sea, right? The U.S. enforces the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea without having ratified it. The U.S. Navy essentially treats it as customary international law for the way in which it thinks about legal requirements. So that's the essential contour of the deal. But yeah, Katie, like you said, there's a lot of details that have to be hammered out. Notably, what this also will result in is for the Chagos people, which is sort of the historical justice angle, allowing them to return to the other 60-ish islands, with the exception of Diego Garcia. So it's not really a perfect agreement for some of the Chagos people. So I think there will still be some criticism of the Mauritius government in particular for taking this deal without fully evicting the UK and the US. But in my view, I mean, this represents the most realistic resolution of this particular sovereignty issue, right? It is, again, many of the wounds of the 20th century and decolonization continue to play out in Asia, despite, you know, the fact that we often treat it like history. And I think this is the latest example of that in particular.
Yeah, and it's difficult to sort of navigate in such a way that everybody gets at least a little bit of what they want. I think we should maybe now turn to, you know, how was this announcement received by other interested parties? It was notable that both the US and India almost instantly had announcements that they put out, sort of calling it a historic agreement and welcoming this resolution. I thought the Indian statement was interesting. It said this significant understanding completes the decolonization of Mauritius, which sort of highlights India's interests. The U.S. statement called it a historic agreement and highlighted that Diego Garcia would continue to be accessible by the United States. But I'm curious your sort of take on those two reactions, but also what other reactions have we seen by other interested parties?
Yeah, so I think, you know, those two are really important. And that actually reminds me, I left out one important component of the deal based on what's known right now, which is that Mauritius has apparently made a commitment to the UK to not allow foreign armed forces from accessing or establishing themselves on the outer islands of the Chagos Archipelago. So that's an important kind of geopolitical angle there, right? The elephant in the room here, obviously, is China, which has started to make inroads in the Indian Ocean region. And so this will essentially give an assurance to the UK and the US that at no point will Mauritius sort of use this sovereignty transfer to cut a deal with China. Although I have to say, I mean, big question mark on how this will be implemented in the treaty in a legally binding form, or this essentially might just be a political commitment. And I think, as we know, and as we've discussed repeatedly on this podcast, you know, domestic political changes in many of the smaller countries in the Indo-Pacific and the Indian Ocean region, as we've seen potentially in the Maldives, for instance, and Sri Lanka, can result in a change of disposition towards China vis-a-vis the UK and the US, for instance. In general terms, I mean, you know, I think it's the usual suspects when it comes to international law. India is interesting because India has been involved in arbitration with Bangladesh for resolving the status of maritime claims along the India-Bangladesh frontier. And so, again, to remain consistent with that, I think the Indians would have to have a statement that essentially supported this kind of an arrangement. And the decolonization language, I think, relates to India's broader, longer-term interests in supporting you know, decolonization, the non-aligned states, the global south, so to speak. Apart from that, I mean, you know, you haven't really seen too much critique, I would say, from countries like China, who've largely, I think, refrained from making too big of an issue out of this. Because, again, I think what's interesting with China is obviously the Hong Kong president, right? The UK transferred sovereignty of Hong Kong back to China under special administrative status in 1997. And so critiquing this would raise, I think, an uncomfortable double standard for the Chinese as well. And so really, I think this is being seen as an example of a member of the P5. I don't know if you'd consider the UK a global power anymore, but a member of the P5 at least, making a good faith effort to comply with international law. So in that sense, I think this is again to be welcomed. And I think the other thing I would just flag here is I think this raises an interesting potential opportunity for India as well, which, India sort of sees itself as the net security provider in the Indian Ocean region with a lot more of an ability, particularly with naval forces, to respond quickly to sort of natural disasters, crises, which India has done in recent years. So I think with this sovereignty transfer, we could additionally see India starting to play a more prominent role in engaging with Mauritius and becoming more active in the southern Indian Ocean region, even with this deal going through.
All right. Well, unless you have any final thoughts, Ankit, I think we can wrap it up there. Interesting sudden development in the Indian Ocean, which is obviously very important to us here at The Diplomat.
Yeah, I think the only other thing that I would add here is the implementation of this, I think, will be interesting, and I think the kind of treaty process will continue to receive a bit of scrutiny, at least in the domestic politics of the UK. The other thing, I mean, this is nowhere in the Indo-Pacific, but I just wanted to flag for listeners that might be interested. I mean, there is sort of, I think, an interesting debate playing out in the UK about whether the acceptance of this sovereignty transfer might have implications for the UK's other overseas territory. I mean, most notably the Falklands and Gibraltar. I don't really know, but I think it's an interesting kind of thing to just float here in terms of the longer term implications. But yeah, Katie, I think we can leave it there today.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. If you have not yet, please leave us a review, and you are always welcome to write to Ankit or I with ideas for future episodes. We'll be back soon with more.